This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Willkommen zurück bei der Berliner Sportschau. Unser Thema heute, der Handballer Kretsche ist wieder aktiv.
Richtig gehört. Ich bin wieder aktiv und zwar für Spreequell aktiv.
Ach so.
Ja, habe ich immer dabei als Sportvorstand der Füchse Berlin. Da ist immer was los. Probier doch mal.
Ah, erfrischend fruchtig und ohne Zucker. Spreequell aktiv. Da werde ich direkt Fan.
The world is on the brink. Wars, contentious elections, disinformation spreading at warp speed, and Donald Trump at the center of all of it. But what does it mean for the rest of us? Every week on Pod Save the World, Tommy Vietor and I cut through the noise to explain how global power is shifting. No jargon, no homework, just clear, honest conversations about what's happening and why it matters. From breaking news to long simmering international conflicts, we dissect it all with critical analysis and some jokes that will surely embarrass our children one day. Tune in to Pod Save the World every Wednesday, wherever you get your podcasts, or catch it on YouTube.
You're about to listen to a brand new series of Lady Killers with Lucy Worsley. Episodes will be released weekly wherever you get your podcasts, but if you can't wait, head over to BBC Sounds where you can listen to the latest episodes a whole week earlier, first on BBC Sounds. If you'd like to stay up to date with the latest episodes, make sure you subscribe to Lady Killers on the BBC Sounds app and have push notifications switched on.
Welcome to Lady Killers with me, Lucy Worsley, from BBC Radio 4. This is where true crime meets history with a twist. Imagine it's 1801. You're a black teenager in rural Pennsylvania and you're enslaved. You're worked to the bone, constantly beaten by your mistress and sneaked on by her children. I wonder if a desire for revenge might drive you to commit the crime of murder.
Sometimes the punishments of hell required no transgressions at all.
I said to Chloe, it was not worthwhile to deny it. Her countenance would condemn her. It was plain she had a hand in it.
My greatest motive was to bring all the misery I possibly could upon the family, and particularly upon my mistress.
Join us as we take a look, a feminist look actually, at historic crimes to find out what they tell us about women's lives, both then and now. We hear their words, we hear their voices as they echo through time. Today I'm investigating the story of Chloe, an enslaved black teenager who in January 1801 is accused of taking her mistress's children down to the creek and drowning them. Is she just a killer who shows no remorse? Or is this a form of resistance, a way of taking justice for herself? Please be aware that this episode contains material that you might find distressing. I'm delighted to be joined by a guest detective who's no stranger to Lady Killers. She's a professor of African American history at Howard University in Washington, D.C., and the author of Brooding Over Bloody Revenge, Enslaved Women's Lethal Resistance. Welcome back, Dr. Nikki M. Taylor.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, Nikki, you're book, it talks about lethal resistance among enslaved women. What did you discover?
Well, contrary to what most historians have studied before now, I found that there is a significant number of enslaved women who resisted using lethal force. We had previously been taught that they resisted covertly, like maybe food poisoning or talking back or pretending to be sick to get out of work. But here in my book, I found women who plotted sometimes for weeks, months, or even years, plotted revenge, and they used lethal force to execute that revenge.
Now we're focusing on Chloe's story today, and we will get to hear from Chloe herself. I find it very surprising that we actually hear Chloe's words as much as we do. Is it unusual?
Absolutely. For enslaved women in the United States, there's only a handful of those women whose words were recorded and preserved in the historical record. So to have her words a very young girl who basically discussed her motivations and also discussed what her life was like in rural Pennsylvania. So it is a treasure for a historian to have found her words.
Yes, this is a really insightful story of her life, I think. Let's get on with our case. In 1801, Chloe is living with the Carrovers family. Andrew and his wife Mary, who were farmers in East Pennsboro Township in Cumberland County, Pennsylvania. The couple have 11 children, and they live in a modest home with nearly 300 acres of farmland. Chloe is the first enslaved person that they've purchased. Nikki, what's Chloe's life like on this farm?
Chloe was born in 1782, and by the time she was 14, she had lived with seven owners. The average enslaved person in the U.S. only was sold three times. And so for her to have been sold seven times as a 14-year-old was probably not only destabilizing, but also very infuriating on many levels. Chloe is incredibly isolated in rural Pennsylvania. She doesn't have her family, her parents, her siblings. She is alone, without a community, without a church, and she hardly ever leaves the confines of the Carruthers farm. Moreover, Chloe is not only a field slave, but she's also a house slave. And what that means is that she does the work of both. She tends to the field, the farm. She also does the washing, the cooking, and the cleaning. So she had backbreaking labor around the clock with very little reprieve.
I guess a lot of British people would imagine the life of an enslaved person as being on a plantation with lots of other enslaved people around them, but not the case. Chloe is isolated. And she's what's at the time is called a term slave. What's that mean, Nikki?
Term slave or a post-naughty slave is a term that was given to enslaved people in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania who were, according to the Gradual Abolition Act of 1780, if they were born after March 1 of 1780, then they would be freed on their 28th birthdays. So that's where we find Chloe. She's a beneficiary. She was born after March 1, 1780. But she doesn't understand herself as being anything other than an enslaved person.
Now, for Chloe, murder is the last resort. Before that point, she commits all sorts of more everyday acts of resistance, talking back, disobedience, feigning illness. She even tries to burn the house down, thinking that it might force the family to put her up for sale. But it doesn't work. She calls her vengeful thoughts her temptations.
To effect this revenge, one day my master and mistress being from home, I felt a strong propensity to burn the barn, and so far yielded to the temptation that I carried fire twice to the hog house, which was near to the barn, and did my utmost to burn it, but could not effect my purpose.
After the arson fails, Chloe admits to feeling another temptation.
A second temptation came into force, that I should destroy my master's youngest son. But I failed in this also.
Her final plan is a desperate one. It's to kill the family's youngest daughter, Lucetta. Nikki, this seems like an extreme act. Can we speculate at all on Chloe's mental state?
Her mental state is one of successive traumas that she endured with various enslavers in Philadelphia. In addition to that, the daughters who were ordered by their mother, Mrs. Carruthers, to surveil and also tattletale on Chloe and report to their mother all the ins and outs of what Chloe was doing. And so she was in a perpetual cycle of surveillance, reporting, and then these horrific beatings where she's stripped naked and beaten with a cowhide leather strap. And she didn't have anybody that could understand what she was going through as she is enslaved there by herself.
Mm-hmm. Oh, Poor woman. Now, Nikki, up until this moment, no one has been able to locate the area of the homestead where Chloe lived or the creek where we think the murders took place. But with the help of the Cumberland County Historical Society, we think that we've located the scene of the crime, don't we? And you went to visit.
I am 100 miles north of Washington, D.C., in rural Pennsylvania, in a town called Carlisle. I am currently standing about one half of a mile from where young Chloe would have lived and worked. East Pennsboro community was a small rural farming community made up of roughly 2,300 farmers, 11 people of color, and 31 enslaved people. Back then, the Carruthers family had two structures located on their property. One was a two-story log cabin with two rooms. The top floor of that cabin was used for sleeping quarters. This family of 13 was the typical middle-class family for the area. I'm standing by a patch of water called Simmons Run. It's very picturesque. It would have been common practice then for families to use a creek like this, not only to collect water and bathe, but also to wash clothing, which would have been the primary responsibility of domestic help such as Chloe. In addition, we noticed that the creek is very shallow and there's hardly any current. And so Mary Carruthers noted that she knew her children would have crawled out of that creek on their hands and knees unless someone had held them underwater. It's a beautiful day and a beautiful location. It's really hard to imagine the grisly scene that happened in 1801 here.
Historical records and court testimony tell us what happened here at the creek. On Saturday morning, on the 24th of January, 1801, Mary Carruthers sends her three daughters, Sally, Polly, and Lucetta, to wash clothes in the creek with Chloe. Chloe later confesses that while she's standing at the edge of the creek, she decides to hurt Lucetta.
I immediately laid hold of her mouth and held it as long as I could, no longer perceive any breath. Then I threw her into the run, took the water, and entirely forgot what I had done until about an hour after.
They return to the farm around 3 p.m. and Andrew Carruthers asks if Lucetta is with them. No, she isn't. They make a search. But even after Lucetta's body is recovered, no one suspects murder. Instead, they believe that the girl must have drowned. Chloe's hoping that now her mistress is grieving, the beatings will stop. Lucetta's funeral is the next day. After it, though, Mrs. Carruthers makes Chloe strip naked and beats her in front of the family, including boys her own age. What a shocking humiliation for a teenage girl.
She made me strip off my short gown and gave me a severe whipping with a cowskin.
And on the Tuesday, Mrs. Carruthers whips Chloe again and...
on the following Saturday, she gave me a third beating. After this, I was determined on further revenge.
Chloe is sent to the creek again, this time with another of the Carruthers' daughters, six-year-old Polly. And Chloe asks her,
why you told everything upon me?
My mother wanted me to.
You shall never tell any more on me. I laid my hand upon her mouth and held it near the space of half an hour. Then I threw her into the run.
This is Mary Carruthers' account of what happened next.
She came running up and wringing her hands and pretending to be crying, said that Polly was in the dam. After the corpse was moved for the graveyard, I thought, and it run in my mind, that she had drowned them.
Chloe has carried out her lethal resistance, her bloody revenge. But will she confess to the murders? Nikki, that's powerful stuff we've heard there. We've now got two dead children and an increasingly suspicious mother. But What do you think? Is the catalyst for all this violence actually the relationship between Chloe and Mary Carruthers?
Absolutely. I do think that one of the motives for her was to maximize the misery to Mrs. Carruthers, who was a cruel and exacting tormentor of Chloe. She's been humiliated and she's been beaten endlessly. I mean, this snapshot that we hear in this story is that she was given 3 brutal beatings in the course of a week. 3.
Let's hear it in Chloe's own words.
The reason why I killed them was not because I had any spite or malice against them. On the contrary, I loved them both. My motive in the first place was this. I knew that the children were compelled by my mistress to give information respecting some parts of my conduct, for which I was severely corrected, far beyond the demerit of the fault. To cut off this means of communication was the first end I promised myself. But my second and greatest motive was to bring all the misery I possibly could upon the family, and particularly upon my mistress.
That to me is, well, I guess I'd call it premeditated revenge. But Nikki, I think an important concept here is the idea of just desserts. Is that right?
So just desserts is an ancient concept going back millennia. And it's included in the Hammurabi Code, the Bible, the Torah. And it's this idea that people should receive the kind of justice as measured by their actions. And so this is, in fact, one of the concepts that undergirds the U.S. penal system. And there's a degree of proportionality. You know, people wouldn't be sentenced to death for stealing a pocketbook. And so people might argue that Chloe maybe went too far with murdering these 2 young babies a week apart. But in her mind, these 2 girls, Lucetta and Polly, she saw them as proxies of their mother. And so she didn't have those moral pangs of conscience that we might expect when it comes to murdering children. And in many ways, the institution of slavery in the United States blurred all of those lines.
Just listening to Chloe's words that we heard, 2 things strike me. One is that she said that she loved the children. And another, she said that after she had killed the first child, she forgot that she'd done it for an hour. Like she'd had to overcome something within herself to kill this child that at certain times she loved. That speaks to me of conflict within Chloe. This wasn't easy for her, was it?
No, it wasn't. And you're absolutely right. She spent a lot of time with them. So even though they were instruments of their mother, I think that there was a level of fondness, at least, that she felt towards them.
The world is on the brink. Wars, contentious elections, disinformation spreading at warp speed, and Donald Trump at the center of all of it. But what does it mean for the rest of us? Every week on Pod Save the World, Tommy Vietor and I cut through the noise to explain how global power is shifting. No jargon, no homework, just clear, honest conversations about what's happening and why it matters. From breaking news to long simmering international conflicts, we dissect it all with critical analysis and some jokes that will surely embarrass our children one day. Tune in to Pod Save the World every Wednesday, wherever you get your podcasts, or catch it on YouTube. No.
Back to the case. With Mary Carruthers already suspicious that Chloe has killed both Lucetta and Polly, the next week is full of accusations, fear, and physical abuse. Mary repeatedly confronts Chloe to try to get a confession from her. She threatens her twice, firstly with death, and secondly that she'll be sold. Eventually, Chloe confesses to both the murders.
I was much whipped by my master to extort a confession.
What does she actually face now, Nikki, going forward to trial? How does it work for someone in her position?
Well, someone in her position would be given a trial and even a defense attorney, and she would have a very swift trial made up of a jury of all white males, no witnesses, and Black people throughout most of the United States were not allowed to testify in court against a white person. And so it would have been very unusual if, even if she had a person to vouch for her, that they would have even be allowed to do so.
Nikki, would the jury sitting in Chloe's case have been made up of enslavers?
Of course. At that time, the juries for enslaved people's trials were always made of white men, and most of those would be enslavers.
What do you think that they felt as they judged Chloe? I mean, I guess it must be the nightmare if you're a slaveholder that your own enslaved people will rise up against you.
Yes, these men, jurors, and even the entire community would have been outraged, of course, that she had dared to resist in this way. But there's also this idea that if they let her off, then perhaps it might inspire other enslaved people in Cumberland County to use the same type of method against their own enslavers.
Well, I think we know what's going to happen next. On the 4th of March, 1801, Chloe's in court and an all-white, all-male jury deliberates for just half an hour before returning with a verdict of guilty for both murders. 3 days later, Chloe is sentenced to be hanged by the neck until she be dead. Nikki Taylor is back in Carlisle in Pennsylvania to meet Mary Lou Shorman of the Cumberland County Historical Society to visit the area where Chloe's story ends.
Hi, Mary Lou. Tell me about this prison, the old Cumberland County prison.
The prison where Chloe spent her time before and after her trial. The current prison is not where she was housed. That was built 100 years after the prison that she was housed in.
What would it have been like for her in jail here?
Actually, we have some letters from British prisoners of war who were sent here in 1777. They said that the jail was probably the worst on the continent and that it really was more of a ruin than a jail. The windows had no glass in them, and they said that the winds just came through the jail like a colander.
It sounds pretty horrendous. Now, how many days was she captive in this prison?
146 days. Wow. We do have a record. The prison keeper kept a log of everyone that was in prison that year. So we have one for March of 1801, and you have Negro Chloe listed as the slave of Andrew Carruthers, the date that she was imprisoned, which is February 23rd, 1801. You'll see that there are two other women in prison at the same time with her, Negro Chloe and Negro Margaret. They were runaway enslaved persons, and I like to think that at least she had some women to talk to.
Right. So I know Chloe was executed on July 18, 1801.
Yes.
Can you tell us a little bit about just what her experience would have been like with that?
Yes. The prison was on the High Street. And about a half a mile straight down High Street were the gallows. They were on the commons of Carlisle at the edge of town. She would have been brought out of jail, put in a cart, and she would have seen, as she was driven down High Street, people on both sides of the street, probably yelling at her, yet calling her names.
I'm sure.
She may have been pelted with vegetables, even stones. She could see the thousands of people that were gathered. Hangings were a moral event and a festive event. Yeah. It really was to show the people, this is what happens when you do terrible things. She reaches the ground. She gets out of the cart. They escort her onto the platform. And then the trap door opened, and she fell to her death.
It seems like a horrific, if not also sickening, end to a young girl's life who lived with such inhumanity and brutality while she was enslaved. And so it just is such a chilling story.
It's a story that I'm glad will be told.
Yes, me too.
It's really chilling to hear about the injustice that Chloe received. But have things improved in America today for Black women who get into the justice system?
Maybe only slightly, unfortunately. In general, African-American women are overrepresented in the prison system, and they tend to be overly convicted for charges, and they have more stringent sentences, at least compared to their white counterparts. There's so many similarities between the judicial system in the 19th century and even today. For example, there was a young girl by the name of Centoya Brown Long, who in 2004 was charged with murdering one of the men that she was with sexually. And it turns out she was being trafficked. The court and the judge wouldn't allow her to bring in her longer history of being trafficked. And so she spent 15 years in prison for that crime. And it wasn't until 2019 when she got clemency and was released. And so that brings us to Crystal Kaiser, who in 2018 in Kenosha, Wisconsin, murdered her enslaver, who was a white man named Volar. And similar to Chloe, the judge in that case refused to allow her defense team to bring in Volar's activities as a trafficker. And so that meant the cards were stacked against Crystal Kaiser. In many ways, we're horrified to hear that these cases were not 100 years ago or even 50 years ago. They're less than a decade old. And so these things are happening right here today.
Nikki, what do you take away from the story of poor Chloe?
We're left with this idea that slavery all the way around, whether it be in the North or the South, was horrific and traumatic, and it led to these sorts of outcomes. And so in many ways, it was just as dangerous for the enslavers as it was for the people enslaved. What it takes to have somebody enslaved and to try to take their will, their dignity, their humanity, it doesn't always end well. It doesn't always end well for the enslavers. Sometimes it did, in most cases it did, but sometimes people would act out and resort to lethal force, especially if all their other efforts to get relief were met with dust. And so this was the case with the Carruthers family. They never again purchased another enslaved person. And thus, their beginning and the end of their history as enslavers rested with Chloe, and she had the final word in their family.
Of course, in this case, we can't condone what Chloe did, but I think we can get a glimmer of understanding into why she did it. What surprises me about this case is how small and almost quiet an act of resistance this is. I'd assumed that a slave revolt meant many people burning down a plantation house, but this was just one child quietly drowning another. But what'll really stay with me from my conversation with Nikki is her insight that the institution of slavery contains the seeds of its own downfall. If you enslave people, you have to expect that they might in turn kill you and your children too. Many thanks to Dr. Nikki M. Taylor, Mary Lou Shorman, and the Cumberland County Historical Society. Next time, I'm in London's exclusive Knightsbridge, where a rich and glamorous young woman is accused of murdering her lover. Lady Killers with Lucy Worsley on BBC Radio 4 is produced by Julia Habel, and the readers are Moya Angela and Ruth Sillers. The executive producer is Kirsty Hunter. The series historical consultant is Professor Rosalind Crone, and the commissioning editor for BBC Radio 4 is Rhiann Roberts. It's a Story Hunter production for BBC Radio 4. And you can listen first to the episodes if you search for Lady Killers on BBC Sounds. See you next time.
I'm Paul Kenyon, and for Radio 4 and the History Podcast, this is Two Nottingham Lads.
When the invasion happened, it was completely hell on earth with the sounds.
The sad thing about war is people lose their empathy and their humanity.
I want to know how two men from Nottingham ended up on opposite sides in the war in Ukraine, and what became of them after a chilling encounter in a prison in Donetsk.
Out of all the places in the world where I meet someone from Nottingham, it's in captivity, on two sides of the conflict.
It's a story about how and why you pick a side in a war that's not your own. You can listen to Two Nottingham Lads first on BBC Sounds.
The world is on the brink. Wars, contentious elections, disinformation spreading at warp speed, and Donald Trump at the center of all of it. But what does it mean for the rest of us? Every week on Pod Save the World, Tommy Vietor and I cut through the noise to explain how global power is shifting. No jargon, no homework, just clear, honest conversations about what's happening and why it matters. From breaking news to long simmering international conflicts, we dissect it all with critical analysis and some jokes that will surely embarrass our children one day. Tune in to Pod Save the World every Wednesday, wherever you get your podcasts, or catch it on YouTube.